Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is another episode about films at IDFA, the International Documentary Film Festival, Amsterdam. And I'm here again, or I was there, and now I'm here somewhere else, and now he's somewhere else, but we're converging on the festival's films with Eric Hines, a curator of film at the Museum of the Moving Image.
It's good to be back. And yeah, I mean, very typical of us that we struggled to get this together when we were both in town because we were running around town, but good to catch up with you here.
Yeah, it ended up meaning that we, I think, saw a few more films that we'll be able to talk about. And now that we know what the award winners were, we can talk about the one that got the top prize in the international competition. And that's 1489.
Shogokat Vardanyan.
Yes. Did you see this on the big screen there?
I did both, actually. I saw it ahead of time. I wound up doing a talk with Shogokat at the festival. So I watched it in advance, and then I did watch it with an audience before the talk.
Oh, great.
It's an Armenian film about Shogokat and her parents in a kind of limbo state. There is a resumption of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan in September 2020. You know, just a matter of weeks, but it was a very bloody, very tragic resumption of a long-standing conflict over the Artsakh region, you know, contested territory. But this is a very raw first-person account of the limbo state that she and her parents were in because her brother was missing in action. It's kind of a diaristic approach to looking for information about him and also just waiting and struggling with that. You know, the story does, you know, there is a revelation over the course of the film, but most of what you're watching is that limbo state that they're in. You're also kind of watching a filmmaker become on screen. You know, it sort of starts as very kind of just plant the camera on the table and let it roll, and then at other times there's more of a moving camera, and there's also, you know, moving locations, not just in the apartment that they're in. So yeah, it's a very, very interesting film, both in terms of what you're watching and how it's told.
You know, visually, it starts out with these compositions where you're just in the house where the filmmaker is, I guess, basically staying or living, I wasn't quite sure, with her father, who's a sculptor, and her mother. And yeah, it's defined by their waiting for some update or news about her brother, their son, who's missing in action, but they sort of know when that happened. And, you know, the home life looks, you know, they have this beautifully arranged, like, studio space and home, you know, the cozy domesticity of like the bedroom or something. But yeah, then when they go on the road a bit, you know, to get more information, all of that really changes. It's crazy. It really turns into a pretty harrowing movie. They don't shy away from what it ultimately means when you do find out what happened to a loved one in war. And that's like a gesture that becomes kind of, I don't know, the supreme, the kind of culminating gesture of the film, that you go from like silence and absence to like just the facts of death.
Yeah. Which is a bit related, I think, to witnessing through the way that it's told a kind of filmmaker come into being, and a very, very interesting filmmaker come into being. I think this is just descriptive. It's not meant as a slight whatsoever, but there's a sense of naivete to how the footage is captured a lot of the time. And I do think that it's almost like a naivete of inexperience of filmmaking and history of questions about what should or should not be depicted that allows her to make like these incredibly radical, daring choices. She's not doing so for the sake of challenging the comfort levels of documentary film viewers or the lines of ethics in terms of documentary filmmaking. It's just what seems right and what the camera should be doing. And it's kind of amazing for that, because as you're not watching an artist looking to challenge you in a formal way. You're watching an artist wrestling with something, dealing with something, and using the camera to do it.
It really has a way of feeling like you're kind of lurching through it with her. I mean, and she's gets such a vivid, like, emotional portrait of people involved as well. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it sort of helps, I guess, that her father has this like extremely like expressive, like, and sort of weathered, bearded face. I mean, he looks like a painting on an icon or something. And he also has like an interesting way of trying to figure out the facts involved. He asks soldiers, maybe like squad mates or people who might know the son, will draw me like what happened where. That was somehow very, very moving and vivid as well. And then the mother, I guess, has sort of taken refuge in, yeah, she's sort of, I guess, more openly in denial about what might have happened to the son, and that there's a little tension in that as the film goes on. But the director's just true to whatever people are feeling. And then they have like a cousin who helps them at some point. I don't know, it's they're just kind of these sketches of people and personalities.
He's so briefly depicted, but also like such a strong presence, that cousin, you know, and so moving. Yeah, these little sketches go a long way.
Yeah, I guess in a way I'm kind of glad that the movie is recognized in this way, because you know I could also see somehow a world where it kind of is not noticed, or is it, you know, because there's definitely a drama to the way it ends, but there's also something kind of unassuming about it, you know.
There's something I think ultimately persuasive about that, because you kind of can't question the motivations as a viewer. Like, who are you to question motivations in a situation like this? This is, and you're kind of invited, and it's a privilege to be, you know, it's hard, but it's also a privilege to be invited into this. And I think that's kind of where that conversation kind of needs to stay.
Yeah, I wonder if now might be where I can mention the opening film from this year, just because it, in a way, I mean, it's like another variety of personal filmmaking, a personal essay style, more steering into like a more distilled essay style than this one, which you could sort of maybe imagine, you know, could have been a possible approach to 1489.
I missed it. So yeah, please tell me about it.
Yeah, that's A Picture to Remember. Ola Czernik is the director. I think it's her debut feature, and it stood out to me because it's about or around, you know, Ukraine conflict, but it's really something where she focuses on her family and kind of the generations that have grown up under, you know, first Soviet Empire and then this ongoing shocks and aftershocks of what has to be called, I guess, the Russian Empire at this point again. But it is a style that is personal observations, but not like returning to, you know, the war as an on-screen like main event. So A, it's interesting for that reason, because a lot of the great documentaries coming out of Ukraine right now are understandably, you know, different ways of grappling with violence. And B, I mean, a lot of them, I think, or most of them are directed by men. So this is kind of more concertedly looking at continuities through history and how people have survived, you know, like her grandmother and then her mother, who, in the kind of like central like metaphor of the movie, her mother is a pathologist working in a morgue. So that's where they've holed up. That's kind of like the physical place for the movie, even though it goes like around in time and lots of zooms with her grandmother. But yeah, so just not on the battlefield in the same way. It's sort of casually complex is kind of what the way I was thinking about it.
Is there a voiceover? How is it handled, the first person aspect of it?
Yeah, there is a voiceover, and it's definitely like a kind of composed voiceover. Like it's thoughtful. It's not like an off-the-cuff sort of thing. She's definitely guiding us through the past, reflective. It's not the same kind of immediacy as 1489. Not that these movies are in any way comparable, but just because they are,
Sure.
you know, I just thought it's kind of interesting to drop that one in there as well.
Well, that question sort of interests me, because as 1489 is takes an interesting approach where there's a lot of text, right? There's a lot of opening text and there's a lot of closing text, and then from there it's sort of somewhat diaristic, but again not narrated, just in terms of her looking directly into the camera at times and her filming her family in these intimate moments. But yeah, it does without voiceover. And then another film I think we both saw, Chase the Dazzling Light, also absconds with voiceover, but there's a lot of voice in the soundtrack in terms of what constitutes the audio.
Yeah, and that's also ties in because I find a lot of it's the state of the world now. We're just all in a state of like waiting, you know, whether it's for the other shoe to drop or if it's for, you know, some kind of reckoning or justice that's hasn't come, whether it's for decades or centuries, and is not any looking to come anytime soon. But just this state of suspension, which is not a great one. But that also, yeah, if you want to talk about Chase the Dazzling Light, that's also what's going on there.
Yeah, no, and what's interesting too is that plot-wise, it's similar to, say, films from 4 or 5 years ago, in kind of light of the war in Syria, right? Of filmmakers being in exile of sorts and being separated from family and corresponding. There's some very, very good films from several years ago about that. And this is that plot again, except there's just people just still living this way. It's just year upon year upon year. And I appreciated that. You know, it's not like there was some gauntlet being set down, like, okay, you must have this story take on different contours. It's like, no, this is actually is pretty similar story. It's just that the lives keep going on. You know, parents get older and those in exile start figuring out a new life. Like, what does that look like? Where do you work? Where do you live? Do you set down roots? Do you keep living in limbo for another 5 years before figuring out what the next chapter of your life is? You know, I know you already talked about it in a previous podcast, but Life is Beautiful, Palestinian film, is also about a filmmaker caught far from home and trying to connect with home while moving forward. Chasing the Dazzling Light, I enjoyed because it's basically a conversation between the filmmaker Yasser Kassab and his father, who's back in Syria. And the father is very opinionated about his son's filmmaking and about his life choices. So we get a little bit of Yasser's wife is in the film too, and a lot of the father in very kind of engaging, funny, not abusive way. Just kind of railing Yasser about his filmmaking choices, what type of films he should make, what's wrong with the films that he has made. And this is you know, neither of us have seen this. There have a couple other films in this mode. I guess this is the third in a trilogy. The previous ones were On the Edge of Life and I Have Seen Nothing, I Have Seen All. But, you know, part of the joke here is that the father thinks that it's time for Yasser to make a different type of film, maybe something that has more marketability, which is pretty funny. And Yasser is just a very deadpan figure. You know, I wonder if it's even put upon after a while because it's just a very successful deadpan that he has throughout. No matter what his father's saying, he's just sort of going along with it.
Yeah, I kind of wondered that as well because it's such a like gentle, kind of hapless persona,
Yeah.
you know, especially even when he's not on the screen. Like, there are these extended shots of his partner, she's just like texting, and then you have to think, wait, he's just watching her texting, you know, which is like a whole nother level of like haplessness and just stasis, you know. He's not even communicating, or at that point with him, he's just watching her. And I don't even know that she says too much in the film, which is also becomes a kind of for me became like a running joke, you know.
Exactly. There's also clearly a choice that he's making to invite his father to say things, even though he's probably not going to take that advice.
Yeah, there's also like advice like you got to choose a title, you know, and that's where you start. And then I guess his father must say that so much because that his mother also, I think, says that at one point. It's like, yeah, that's what you got to do, you know. That's how it's done. And I mean, there's just something also just appealing about like the bluntness of this wisdom. And then you kind of listen to someone and you're like, well, he's not wrong about all of it. And sometimes there's a clarity to it. And then at the same time, you're like, well, you know, it's just not how it works. Like, you can't just, you know, tell a person how to make a movie. It's just.
Especially since they're not at all what his instincts are for making a movie.
Exactly. Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah. And what the movie is, I mean, the images are of placid Sweden,
Yes.
you know, and which again, like these are like always held up as like the models of these stable societies. It's like nothing happens, and that's a good thing. So the visuals for this movie are, yeah, these kind of very blank interiors and, you know, quiet exteriors. You know, like in Life is Beautiful, there's definitely like this that there it's building up the nerve-wracking tension of a clock running out. This is almost like a different kind of anguish, which is so like sublimated. It's just like you're in purgatory, that limbo space you said with the other movie. Yeah.
But also beneath all of this is the that tension of can they make steps towards making a life for themselves away from home, you know, and is that going to be acceptable or okay in terms of his parents, you know, and it's clear that the parents in their own way are kind of blessing that as painful as it is. And that's such a pain. It's sort of unimaginably painful, you know, in terms of not only to be away, but then kind of committing maybe to permanently being, maybe not permanently being away in terms of not seeing one another, but permanently being away in terms of living abroad.
Yeah, that's so true. And just the permanent diasporic condition of like everyone's elsewhere. And I think even his mother, it's like, well, what are you up to? And she's like, I don't know, all my friends are gone. You know, they all left, they all moved away too. And she lists like three or four other countries where they are. So it's almost like, is there a home at home even? Is there a feeling of home at home anymore?
And they basically intimate that at some point there's no leaving for them anymore. Like whatever opportunities they could have had if they had chosen that no longer exist.
Yeah. And I don't know, I guess with these films, I did keep thinking about, I mean, I guess I'm always thinking about her work, but I mean, News from Home or La Ba as well, just as kind of ancestors to some of these films. I can't help but think of things sometimes in terms of those approaches as well.
Sure.
The voiceover and the way your landscapes and kind of featureless interiors are being, and static interiors are being used.
And I was also thinking, but this is not a film with this as well. That kind of, am I making a film about this, or are we just talking about making a film? You know, which, you know, I think where some of the humor comes through is that playfulness.
Well, I guess there's one more film that we both saw as well, and actually weren't entirely on the same page about, so I'm looking forward to hashing it out. And that's The Last. The filmmaker is Sebastián Peña Escobar, and it's set in Paraguay, in the Gran Chaco forests, which, you know, are being either burnt down by people and by, I don't know, ongoing climate catastrophe, I guess, wildfires. At a certain point, I couldn't even tell which was going on. It just and it's, I guess, a road movie to nowhere in a way. It focuses on two friends, these two like scientists, basically. One a German-born, I guess, entomologist, Ulf, and a Paraguayan ornithologist, Jota, who are they're doing their thing, which is like driving into deep into nature, where you know they'll either catch or look at you know moths and stuff, or yeah, try to figure out what birds are still surviving there. And yeah, it's very much like a, I don't know, end of the world conversation, you know, this kind of, where do we go from here? Is there any way to go from here? How did we end up here? Is there any hope? That's basically, is that a fair sketch?
No, and you know they're big personalities, Ulf and Jota. You know they're and they've certainly seen enough, but they're also extremely cynical. They're that kind of scientist. They're both that kind of scientist where they're sort of like, "Let us go. We've failed it. You know, let's start all over again." You know, they're very sort of gallows humor. There's a kind of deep, in a sense, earned cynicism about, you know, what's going to be able to be fixed or whether or not the human race is going to be able to figure any of this shit out in time before ruining everything. They're coming from that place.
And it kind of was a little drawn out. I mean, there's an element to it where it's like a couple of guys just kind of running off, the kind of expectation that we're going to find it endearing somehow. I ultimately did like fall in with them. I think some of their gallows observations, just because they're just beyond the point of, like you said, there it's gallows, pretty cynical, I think. And I even managed to look at things in a little bit of a new way when they're talking about like capitalism. I love the formulation. I forget whose it was, but they're just like, why capitalism? You know, it's too expensive. And I love that. I love that because capitalism's whole thing is everything's efficient. It's the best of all possible worlds for each individual person. Wealth is created. But they're just like, no, it's too expensive because it costs you all this, the forest, you know, it costs you nature, it costs you health, it costs you mental health, it costs you physical health. You know, it costs all kind of suffering. And I thought that was just like sort of like a diamond of wisdom, like
So not to be a killjoy, but the what wound up kind of really grating on me is though I did enjoy them, and who doesn't love a road trip, and who doesn't love a road trip with a middle-aged man and two elderly men, you know. There's something about that that is like, Even when you're rolling your eyes, it's sort of that is what it is with these dudes. It's that there's something about these men of education going into one of the last forests in the world, and they're being kind of on the fringes of what we're seeing, and what we're talking about is exactly why there are fires and why the woods are being infringed upon and why there's carelessness involved. And it's interesting that we don't get too specific about that, but we do see only in passing the indigenous populations who actually live in these places. It's something about that dynamic that really wound up getting to me. We're not talking to the people who actually live in these towns and are actually living in the woods. We're kind of coming as outsiders to bitch about it, and so it's something about the fact that there's no voice to the people who live in these places really got to me after a while, because they really are just occasionally shown. There's even a potential implication in a kind of cove in the cove in the sense of like the film, like The Cove, of the sort of educated outsiders implying that those who kind of live in this space don't know how to take care of it, and we should come in and fix it for them. Obviously their cynicism certainly doesn't lead to that kind of intervention, but that wound up sort of getting to me, and therefore I guess that even the kind of like ease of their interactions and that cynicism wind up bothering me, because it's just, it's almost a luxury to think about it in terms of millennia, when there are people struggling every day to figure out how to make it work with, I'm sure, hardly any resources. So I think about that in relation to something like The Territory, where all the sides are explored and you kind of get a sense of like, yeah, there are bad people here, but they're not just the people you think it's going to be. It's actually somebody behind the people who might seem like they're doing the wrong thing that are the real bad guys. And that's just not what's explored. And I gotta say, like, and this is a much less nuanced or critically defensible position to come from, but I feel like if it's about the woods being on fire, we gotta watch, we gotta see a fire. We don't see a fire in the
Yeah.
movie. We only ever see some visual effect where he kind of like cranks the color correcting, so all of a sudden there's like a dark red background when they're kind of hanging out, and that's just not, you kind of have to sell it a little bit, and you kind of need to take us into the fire or near the fire. There are plenty of films that are actually doing that, so it makes it feel a little bit like, well, what does this film consist of?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I felt. I definitely felt like, well, where's the fire? Like literally, where's
Not
the
even
fire?
smoke. There's not even where's if there's smoke, there's fire. There's not even smoke.
You have to try not to show that, I would think, basically.
Yes.
And then also, I'm glad you mentioned The Territory, because that came to mind when you were talking about it, about this film, because yeah, that movie comes at it with so many directions, so many voices, is unsettled because it is unsettling. Whereas yeah, here the forest, I mean, it might as well be an abstraction, in terms of people who actually live there, or even the ranchers. I mean, we get this sort of one shot of a guy kind of strutting around, I felt, who I think is one of the ranchers. I don't know. I mean, also leaving them out is also, it's kind of like the way people with the greatest power
Yes.
are kind of missing. So yeah, where are they? So it is a willful cocooning in a way, even though they're kind of purporting to be very open about how everything's going to hell.
It makes a film about two scientists seem dilettantish, which is crazy because they actually know. They know a lot about this, but something about the form of it makes them seem like dilettantes.
Yeah, and the fact that the movie doesn't really grapple with that, it's almost like he's kind of like too much. I don't want to say too close, but are somehow still in awe or enamored of them, or you kind of need some sort of skepticism beyond that. It's kind of, yeah, too bad.
In terms of not seeing the fire, I mean, I'll just mention this briefly because it's a point of comparison. There's a Danish film in the festival called As the Tide Comes In, which is entertaining. It works. Like, it's a perfectly fine mood piece with the backdrop of climate change. There's this tiny island that is inaccessible to mainland Denmark except for twice a day when a land bridge you know, the tide goes down and there's a land bridge to get to the island. And the question is, there's only like 30 people who left in this island, and what's going to happen with the sea levels rising at some point? That land bridge will be gone, or will the island be gone? You know, there have been significant floods that have wiped out the village in the past. It's a compelling place and there are really compelling characters in it, but we barely see a tide come in. Like you don't have that kind of money shot of even seeing the land bridge covered. And there's never a storm either. There's a lot of like the sound mix is kind of creating sounds of thunder and all that stuff, but you don't even see kind of a torrential storm or a significant tide surge. And And that just winds up like, yeah, that's a little bit cheap. They could have probably used stock footage. So what am I asking for here? To me, what it does, it kind of leads me to think that maybe in both cases, there's just not a lot of footage. I hate to be crass about that, but like, how much time did you spend there if you didn't get those things, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's somehow not grounded in a way, or like I have a sense of where they're going, but also not really, like, coming back to the last,
yeah, yeah.
You know, so
right.
Yeah, when that happens, I guess the lack of like representing what's on the ground is yeah, I would believe that that's the reason for it, what you're saying. I want to make sure we have time to talk about one movie that I know you said is a big highlight for you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So there's a film, a Brazilian film, Behind Closed Doors.
Yeah.
I know you had talked about Limitation. To me, they're really good companions. A filmmaker, João Pedro Bim, who I think is on the younger side. I'm not sure about his previous work, but this is a film that's based around the recent release of an audio recording of Brazil's National Security Council in 1968. Several years after the US-backed coup in Brazil, this government in this audio recording full-on one person after another, you know, ministers from the cabinet, the president, the vice president, in their own words, sanctioning, effectively making useless the Constitution and creating a dictatorship, where they're even, you know, intellectually discussing amongst one another, well, if we do this, you know, this is actually officially a dictatorship. I'm okay with that, but like, we should just call it while we're doing it. And it's just an extraordinary document. And he does something really clever before that, though, where he introduces two other modes of archival exploration of propaganda, different versions of propaganda, you know, either commercials, PSAs, and sort of propagandistic narratives that are introduced first, and then we get to the audio piece. And so what we're looking at are these not even necessarily demonstrative works of propaganda, sometimes it's contrapuntal, whatever. We're looking at him sort of making his way into that material while we're listening to the audio. And it winds up being this really unique experience, a genuinely kind of astonishing reveal of what was happening behind closed doors. So it's a strong, strong film.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like documentary feels kind of like, not in like a hokey way, but it feels like some sort of wizardry that we could be there.
Yes.
And that you can find that.
Yeah.
You wonder like, oh, what was the inflection point in Brazilian history? It's like, well, we were there. We were in the room. Do they say like, was it like a Nixon thing where they're just recording everything? Like, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, only recently were these recordings, as well as a lot of other recordings from the dictatorship, made available. So this might be the first of many, and it could be very much that, where by a matter of course, they were recording it for some sense of history. I don't know.
Hmm.
Or for those who were not present to hear later. I'm not exactly sure. It's possible that was alluded to, but I don't recall that. I'm curious as well about how common it was for meetings like this to be recorded.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, you know, in the time that since we've scheduled doing this, you know, we have like another far right election that went on in Argentina.
Yep.
And I'm sure it's that watching this movie like that, having the proof of when exactly these things were decided is probably cold comfort.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely fascinating. I was just kind of wondering on another tack, whether it's just going a little bit back to the waiting, you know, and we're waiting for history to somehow be fixed because we keep on getting more and more evidence of all the terrible things. It's like, yep, it was just as bad as you thought.
Yep,
someone actually decided to do that. Yes, someone was responsible. They're probably all dead now. And I'm just always left with like the what do you do now?
Yeah. What's interesting, though, too, is that you're used to politicians, lying to your face and claiming things are one thing, but it's really the other. This is one of these moments where you get this proof of, the thing that we all thought was happening and we all said was happening that was being denied was they knew it was happening and they were saying it to each other that it was happening. There's something about that that it's sort of satisfying in retrospect. They may have been blatantly contradicting their actions with what they were saying, but behind closed doors, they knew it.
Which is hugely valuable. So yeah, do you have to run now? Is that
I
right?
have
Or
to, so yeah, so I mean you're back in the States. I'm actually in Porto,
yeah, what brings you to Porto?
a festival called Porto Postdoc. It's my first time here. It's actually the 10th year of this festival, and they've been building up reputation and becoming an essential festival in Portugal while kind of waiting for the renovation of this incredible 100-year-old theater called the Batalha to reopen. And it is now reopened, and it's an incredibly beautiful, gorgeous Art Deco building with now two screens and a preserved bar downstairs and a cafe, and it's a gem, and it's in this kind of arts district of Porto up on the hill. It's a very, very hilly town. It's a good moment for the town. It's a good moment for the festival to have a hub, and I'm staying in a hotel that's literally it's the closest I've ever stayed to the hub of a festival. I'm maybe 10, 15 strides away from the hub at a hotel across the street from it. So that this is the cushiest experience I've ever had in terms of not having to commute. But yes, I do. There are I'm here mostly to view films, local films, looking for premieres, along with other programmers and some works in progress to sort of basically meet some filmmakers earlier in the process rather than at festivals where the films are already circulating. But there's also a pretty impressive competition slate. It's not a world premiere festival necessarily, although I think there is one in the world competition. It's a good, interesting collection of films, and it was where briefly I caught up with a film called Landshaft, and I'll mention Landshaft, plus it relates directly to 1489. It's about the same region and about the fallout from the same conflict. It's made by a German filmmaker who obviously wound up spending a fair amount of time in that region. And I think the entire crew otherwise is Armenian, and talking to Armenians, but not showing their faces out of respect for the volatility, like, is that the conflict has resumed just a couple months ago. So, out of respect for that, so it winds up being a pretty rigorous stylistic approach of kind of being eyeline only cinematography and beautiful cinematography, and audio interviews just never really matched up with who's speaking. So it's a pretty interesting film, and surprised I hadn't sort of seen it anywhere else, but it had a Visions de Real premiere earlier in the year. So that's been the discovery for me. I'm glad for
So that's our disclosed locations now.
it.
So we can bring things in for a landing there. Definitely more films to talk about, but I hope we caught a few that people can seek out or watch perchance to program. But yeah, happy journeys post festival.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is an IDFA podcast. And who did I happen to run into here but recent pod partner, Edo Choi of the Museum of the Moving Image. Hello, Edo.
Hello, Nick.
We're going to talk about some of our film highlights. So let's get right to the movies. I think one thing that you saw recently that I was hoping to see was Limitation.
Yes, I believe in the international competition.
Yep.
So that means it's a world premiere, or at the very least an international premiere.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Georgian film co-directed by Eleni Esatiani and Soso Dumbadze. And it's in a form that I think is at this point pretty familiar and almost conventionalized, which is it's a archival documentary. Every image in the film is archivally sourced. And in this case, it's all sourced via the internet. So it's a kind of open source documentary in a way. It's all like sourced from YouTube, which means that the quality of the footage varies greatly. And it's very clear that the filmmakers are either indifferent to or want to emphasize the fact that the only way to receive this history is through these degraded, compressed, blocky images from the internet. And they want our access to the history to be mediated through that very low resolution, low fidelity filter.
What period? What is the kind of focus of the footage?
The film recounts a sort of blow by blow history of the overthrow of the first president of Georgia elected in 1991, Zviad Gamzakhurdia. And it does so by showing us these video sources and credits the sources along the lines of three generic categories, which is either international media, pro-government media, or pro-opposition media. So every time you see an image, there's a title that does not just appear for a few seconds and go away. There's a title for the duration of the shot that tells you exactly what perspective that shot's been made from.
That's kind of fascinating. Yeah. How does this affect what you're seeing? I mean, are you able to like recognize a certain angle or bias to each sequence you're watching? Or
I think what's interesting about it is that there are times where you are looking at an image that's pro-government, let's say, but the people that you're seeing, you're not really sure if they're on the government side or not. Okay. Or sometimes you're seeing something, an image that's filmed by pro-opposition cameramen, and you're not sure if what you're seeing represents their side, right? Like, it represents their perspective, but does it actually, is the action that's happening, are the people in front of us, you know, there's no explanation, there's no contextual account given for anything that we see. The context is just the footage itself. So everything that we've seen before, and then everything we're going to see after.
Right.
So it's very much a blow-by-blow. It's almost like a historical action film.
Wow.
Yeah.
They do have a trailer available online, and I mean, trailer sounds ridiculous for a movie like this, but the particular sequence that they start the trailer with is this almost like sniper view of a guy sitting on a curb, and you hear sort of gunfire in the background, and he's sitting on a curb, and then eventually clearly he's been hit.
Yes.
And then another man in like a greatcoat sort of runs over to kind of bodily carry this other man to some shelter.
I mean, some of these finds are, and I don't even know if they're finds, they're right there on YouTube, apparently. Mm-hmm. But some of these images are extraordinary. The shadow history that the film, I think, is trying to imply is the fact that this coup d'etat was brought about, perpetrated by, supported by Russia.
Right.
So the film is depicting one thing on the level of what you're seeing, but actually the real history is the history you're not seeing.
Right, right, right.
Which is what's Russia's role in all of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which makes one think of the Sergei Loznitsa film, Mr. Landburgers, which is, was very explicitly felt like, we've been here before, here's the rehearsal, but here's how it came out a different way.
Yeah. And this is very Loznitsa, this is very Andrei Uyaka.
Yeah.
It's a good version of that, but it is familiar. Yeah. It's not reinventing a form. It's putting very effective use to that form, yeah.
That's limitation. What do you make of the title? Is that formal limitation they're thinking of?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems almost an understatement to say that it's political limitation for a coup d'etat. So, yeah, that's an interesting one. And then there was a film that we both saw.
Yeah.
The Clinic, by a director that I think maybe many or most people know from his fiction filmmaking a bit more.
Yeah.
Midi Z.
Taiwanese filmmaker.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, I think, sort of similar to Limitation in some ways, in that it's not similar at all in form, but these are both political films, and they're both films that are trying to show how a nationalist uprising or rebellion against a liberal society takes root. Mm. And, you know, begins to metastasize through a populace and a nation state. This specifically deals with Myanmar and a couple in Myanmar who are seemingly small town doctors.
Yeah.
It's sort of unclear to me whether they're in rural Myanmar or whether they're in just sort of suburban Myanmar, but they're definitely not in a place that's well serviced by the healthcare industry or by any form of state healthcare.
Yeah, services of any kind.
Of any kind, yeah. So they're invaluable to the people who come to see them, to their patients, because they actually know something about medicine. Their patients come to them not just for physical care, but for psychiatric care.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that not only are they doctors, they're artists. The wife is a painter, and the husband is kind of an aspiring political filmmaker.
Yeah.
And it's at that point that you start to wonder how much of the film is fictional and how much of it is documentary. Maybe it's all documentary, maybe it's partially fictionalized, but it was started to become unclear to me. And I think that that's a pretty deliberate tactic on Mitty's part. And it's something that's familiar from his other movies. So,
that's interesting. Yeah. I had kind of just taken this one as, maybe to simplify my own reception of film, as pretty straight ahead documentary. Also just because the sequences, I mean, things don't like lock into place in this movie. It's very
that's
much,
true. Yeah.
You know, and also just to give a visual for like what the clinic means, it's not like a big room, you know, with beds or something like that. It really looks like almost more like the back of a store.
Yeah, it's a storefront clinic.
It's a storefront clinic.
Yeah.
And it seems even fitting in the camera crew in the room is sometimes a bit of a struggle.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that's for discretion as well, the way they position the camera. But yeah, people come in, there's a bed, he figures out, he's like a family doctor, you know, he kind of has to take in the whole of their gestalt and like just and also just be a comforting presence. But what's crucial is that for me, that cued me for, based on past experience, that it would be a certain kind of movie, maybe.
Yes.
And it's not that movie at all.
At all. Yeah. Yeah. You sort of expect it to be this straightforward, because for the first 20 minutes or half an hour of it, it is a sort of straightforward verite, like observational film.
Yeah.
About, a small town pair of doctors. And they turn out to be more complex people who are engaged with their society, ethically engaged with it, in multifarious ways. And I think it becomes a very rich, the notion of the clinic becomes a very rich metaphor for the impact that regular people can have on their community, the political impact, the social impact that they can have. And then also what they can't change, what they can't affect, because the film takes us from Myanmar in 2017 or so to Myanmar today, or more or less today, Myanmar after the military coup and then during the COVID-19 pandemic under lockdown. And we see this couple weathering that change. And in the end being confined within the clinic as much as they can. They can't change everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Some things are just beyond what they could possibly tackle. Yeah, and there's a sense of like individual like health or soul health, and then just like the body politic health. You know, there's a woman who's brings, I guess, just a friend of hers who her husband has abandoned her, basically, who is in psychological distress and can barely sleep. She kind of looks sort of calm, which is sort of is unnerving because she's also suffering, and that's very unnerving to know that she's in such psychic pain, basically. And so you have that, and then you also have the backdrop of hatred.
And ultimately ethnic nationalism.
Yes.
As an illness, as a social illness, because one of the most powerful scenes in the movie is when the male counterpart of the couple is presenting his film at a film festival in Myanmar in 2017, and a gentleman whom we don't see but we hear interrupts the Q&A and lambasts the filmmaker for his disrespect for the military. Mm-hmm. And we take it that this older gentleman is a veteran or something like that.
Yeah.
And this is in 2017, and then by the end of the film we're in 2021 and there's been a military coup.
Right.
I
do have to say that the presence of art, you know, and clearly the therapeutic and generative value of art opens up the movie in another way that it's almost nice just to discover. The Doctor is more than an inspiring filmmaker. We get a glimpse of him at work, which is also very interesting, you know, shooting and kind of thinking through his shots and directing. But yeah, that's the kind of interesting turn that the second part of the movie takes. So yeah, that's The Clinic from Midi Z. And moving along to another film, and that film is The World is Family.
Yeah, by Anand Patwardhan.
Yes.
The great Indian documentary filmmaker.
So this is his latest film, and a more kind of intimately personal film.
So I think the film is being presented in either Best of Fests or Signed, which are the two. They're not world premiere sections. They're the sort of summative sections for the year, collecting the documentaries by either established figures that are highly anticipated or the documentaries that the programming team here deems to have been the highlights from the year's festivals. I think this film, maybe it had its international premiere in Toronto.
I think you're right, yeah.
It's a film that Patwardhan described as, in a way, not even intended to be a film. It's comprised almost entirely of the filmmaker's home movie footage of his parents. Probably filmed from the early 90s, I would say, to up until their respective deaths in the 2000s, in the later part of the first decade of the 2000s, early part of the 2010s. And it depicts his parents. Again, he said that he wasn't really initially intending it as a film, but then he started to look at the footage and began editing it spontaneously, and that moved him to kind of make it into a portrait of his parents. But it's not just a personal portrait. It's as the title suggests, The World is Family. Mm-hmm. It's a portrait of the generation that his parents are from. And that was the generation that formed the vanguard of the Quit India movement. They were the young idealists who were not leading the movement, but who were the foot soldiers of the movement, the intellectual foot soldiers of the movement. And they knew, in fact, his mother encountered several times and was clearly some level of friends with, for instance, Gandhi.
Okay.
And other members of the family, because he ends up extrapolating from his parents to cousins and uncles and aunts, and including a section of his family that are in Pakistan. And so the film, through this extrapolation, becomes a collective portrait of that generation, their experience, and the legacy of the Quit India movement, the ousting of the British colonial government, and then finally the bloody partition that ensued, brought upon by the outgoing British colonial government in many ways. And it's a tragic portrait in that sense of the demolished dreams of that generation of people.
Yeah, that's something I have to catch up on. Now I will contribute a film that I've seen, so I don't see like a layabout. The movie I saw recently was Danger Zone. And I mean, it's got a hook and a half for its log line. It's about conflict tourism or war tourism or crisis tourism, I guess. The practice, I almost want to just say, see like Vice Media circa 2010. Because I feel like this movie's subject must have, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I feel like they must have done some like video report on something like this. It's basically people who go to war zones.
Yeah.
It seemed especially ones that have been active. There are these kind of established sites in a way. And it follows a couple of people who kind of run businesses doing this. One of them is like very much like this ex-US military guy, just wraparound sunglasses sort of thing. and then a British guy who I couldn't quite understand his background. And he kind of definitely takes it more in the tourism direction. Like, because he takes a guy who I guess is a married man, I think a Mormon, and who just wants to see the world or something. And he takes this guy to Somalia and is constantly playing up the tensions. He says, oh, it's, you know, look at what's happening here. Our lives are in danger. So you get like not that the movie is trying to say that any of this is like a responsible way to move through the world, but he especially makes it more of a spectacle. In a way, it's kind of shooting fish in a barrel, this film, but it kind of needs to be done. You need to see that this kind of thing exists. The ex-US military guy, he's kind of like scouting out places in Afghanistan, which is as awful as it sounds. You also follow a woman. She goes to Afghanistan, you know. I mean, the shallowness that's involved is still kind of breathtaking, even when you just see how conceptually this is like an inevitable result of like of tourism and a general Western posture towards all of this.
Yeah.
There are, you know, scenes of like them handing like $20 bills to like kids and this sort of thing, you know, or so it's kind of it's exactly what you expect it to be. I can't say like it's a terrifically complex portrait, also partly because it does inevitably hinge on the tensions of going into these spaces, which it could distance itself from a bit more, I think. Have you ever seen anything like this?
I've never.
You haven't? Okay.
Yeah. But I will say just briefly that Limitation, the film we were talking about earlier, has these extraordinary, for me, the most upsetting imagery in the film, footage in the film, are these scenes of the opposition forces, basically this vigilante army that overthrew, you know, a democratically elected government. We see these images of them loading artillery shells into this kind of medieval-looking munitions and firing their guns without really aiming them, and then laughing about it and saying, "Oh, we really fucked them up." And there's a feeling of, if not tourism, because these are participants, there's a kind of sportive feeling to their attitude, and a cavalierness that's really, really just hideous. And I thought that was some of the most memorable parts of that movie. Yeah.
I guess in a way I kind of wanted Danger Zone to go a bit deeper, because it's like, you very quickly grasp the problems involved, so you kind of have to probe them a bit more, even as there is value in just recording it or portraying what's going on. But for what it's worth, that's there. That's the Danger Zone. And I guess we can kind of leave it there.
Sure.
But thank you, Edo, for taking a moment to talk.
Thanks, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapolt. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.